The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. President Trump extends America's stay-at-home guidelines by 30 days.
This is our shared patriotic duty. Challenging times are ahead.
COVID-19 spreads onto one of our aircraft carriers, the USS Teddy Roosevelt.
The whole Navy and all of the armed forces are going to have to stretch here, support the units that go down.
Amidst all this, a relief package is on the way. Senator McConnell's finest moment.
It was a genuine emergency, and we rose to the occasion. I was really proud of my colleagues.
Beltway media politicizes the virus.
Paul Krugman went out there and said, you know, we respond the worst because of Donald Trump. We're approaching the most deaths in the world.
And did China release COVID-19 on purpose? Gordon Chang.
Yeah, I don't think it was an intentional release. It is possible that this was an accidental release from that P4 biosafety lab in Wuhan.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com and let me invite you to join us now by video. And follow me on Twitter at Hugh Hewitt. And follow this program as well at Town Hall Review. In what may have been his most solemn briefing to date, President Trump extended the stay-at-home and social distancing guidelines through the end of April.
This is our shared patriotic duty. Challenging times are ahead for the next 30 days. We're sort of putting it all on the line. This 30 days is so important because we have to get back. But the more we dedicate ourselves today, the more quickly we will emerge on the other side of the crisis and return to our lives, and they will be great lives.
The president did provide hope, but the next 2 weeks will be extraordinarily difficult. After that point, we may get an upper hand over the virus only in America. In a sobering reminder of the seriousness of all this, one of our nuclear aircraft carriers, the USS Teddy Roosevelt, has reported that more than 100 sailors have fallen ill with COVID-19 in the South Pacific, and the ship is now in port at Guam. I spoke with retired Admiral James Stavridis about what this means for our military. I'd like your reaction to what's going on there.
I think the captain, Hugh, has done exactly the right thing. And boy, that takes a lot of leadership in a very tight situation. I think unlike anything a captain has seen, certainly in modern times, he knew he could not continue on his current mission. He's got 5,000 sailors on that ship who you and I both know are packed together in berthing compartments. So there's no way to social distance. There's no way to do the kind of conventional things. And you can't even do what a cruise ship can on the Navy ships, these big berthing compartments, people are just packed in. So the captain had to go to his chain of command and ask to get all of those sailors off the ship. Now, that's extremely hard because to do it right, you've got to get them ashore and get them into individual rooms. And they're on the relatively small island of Guam. 4,500 sailors are going to have to get off the ship, get into hotel rooms, weather this thing for 14 days, and the remaining 10% of the crew, say 500 sailors, are going to stand by on the ship because, newsflash, it's a nuclear aircraft carrier with nuclear reactors. It's loaded with missiles and bombs and high-performance aircraft. You can't just walk away and lock the door.
Now, Admiral Stavridis, the chatter online was that Captain Crozier would be cashiered for going outside of the chain of command and leaking the letter. One, we don't know that he leaked the letter. Number two, I think that would be such blowback on Secretary Esper. I just don't think that's a wise idea. It would be devastating, I think, to morale. What is your thought on that?
it would be devastating, not just on morale, but to operational performance. This is a commanding officer who is exercising strong leadership, speaking truth to power. I find it highly unlikely that a nuclear-trained Navy officer who is also a pilot, naval aviator, has to be to command that carrier. I don't see an individual like that leaking a letter. It is part of a larger picture we ought to mention here, which is that this is not going to be the only time this happens. The TR will not be the only ship that has virus run through it, because the conditions here are so positive for this virus. And by the way, it won't just be the Navy. We're going to see Air Force units that are packed in there. The real nightmare, by the way, Hugh, would be for this to get into our nuclear strategic force and have a ballistic missile submarine have a similar challenge. The whole Navy and all of the armed forces are going to have to stretch here, support the units that go down when they have to come offline. Bottom line, to your question, once it runs through the crew, yes, that will be a positive combat-ready ship, and that's a good thing.
On the positive side of the crisis, we are seeing the private sector step up, offering assistance in ways reminiscent of World War II. My colleagues Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson sized up the situation with Dave Harsanyi, a regular now with National Review, from AM 560 The Answer in Chicago.
So it was great, and it was great to hear from those corporate leaders how they're repurposing the capacity they have to help with the personal protective equipment that's needed to be manufactured and then distributed without having to be forced to do it, volunteering. There's no need to talk about nationalizing companies. I wanted to get your reaction to the effort underway now to put blood on Trump's hands. That was the focus of the Sunday talk shows. And then to focus on the look back, we've got think pieces and Foreign Affairs magazine and other places talking about the time that was lost in February when there should have been all hands on deck for testing. And we lost a month after Trump shut down the border to China travel.
You know, it's been the same way. It's obviously a different situation now, but it's been the same way for 4 years in the sense that, you know, all these people do is make you defend Donald Trump even if you don't like him. Basically, they make fans out of people who wouldn't be, because there's no other way to deal with that kind of rhetoric that's so over the top. Yesterday, just you had the MyPillow guy. Is that
Mike Lindell.
Yeah, Mike Lindell. Right.
Great story, wonderful, seemingly wonderful man. You know, he likes Trump, so what? You know, and he's helping the country, and all you see online is sort of venomous tweets about how stupid he is, or, you know, how he's just using it to, you know, as a commercial, et cetera, et cetera. It's the kind of thing, I think, that creates a lot of Trump fans in this world.
Yeah, and you wrote an article, which I just read about, America's response to coronavirus isn't the worst in the world. Who has it worse than us, and who's doing it better than us?
The reason I wrote that piece was that Paul Krugman went out there and said, we are the worst, you know, we respond the worst because of Donald Trump, and look at, we have the most, we're approaching the most deaths in the world. Obviously, you know, we need to look at this per capita. Every death is a terrible thing, obviously, when it comes to this disease, but we look at it per capita. We don't believe China's numbers, at least I don't. You know, we have more effective tests. We test in a different way, a more humane way if we can, and obviously the tests are ramped up, and now we have more and more of them, so the number's obviously going to go up. It's just silly, and it's just a partisan, you know, they do it to undermine Trump, which is fine. You want to be critical of his reaction initially. I think he should have taken it a bit more seriously, but who could really understand how this was going to, you know, spread when China's lying about it and covering it up? I think it was a difficult spot for anyone.
One hot spot our country has been looking at is China, the source of the plague. Don't ever forget that. But their government and their medical sector have operated with a cloak of secrecy. They allowed robust travel to and from the U.S. to continue for several weeks after the discovery of the virus, until President Trump instituted the China travel ban on January 31st. My Salem colleague Chris DeGaulle spoke with China expert Gordon Chang about the mysteries and conspiracy theories surrounding the virus. From AM 990, The Answer in Philadelphia.
now that we are going through this, and now that I understand kind of the depths of what we're dealing with, that Made in China label takes on a whole new meaning to me.
Yeah, it's really important to buy in America, or at least not buy China. And the reason is, when we buy China, whatever it is, we are enriching a regime that has declared a quote-unquote people's war against us. They did that last May. We have seen this year just the hostility of the regime towards the United States, even blaming us for bringing the virus to Wuhan. We have to understand the maliciousness of the Communist Party of China, and that we are in an existential fight with this regime.
How do you read the president publicly when he talks about China?
Yeah, I don't like the over-the-top praise for Xi Jinping, who is America's number one enemy. But I understand what's happening, and that is President Trump, following the foreign policy consensus of four decades, is basically buttering up the Chinese. You know, Chinese leaders understand that American leaders will oppose them, and they can deal with that. But what they can't deal with is, I think, Trump's liking them one day and disliking them the next. And so that's why we have seen the trend of official and Communist Party propaganda in the last month or so support Joe Biden over Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden over President Trump.
I was going to ask you that question next. How interested do you think China is in our presidential election?
Oh, absolutely, because they realize that China's fortunes are very much tied to the U.S. They're very dependent on us, and they can't actually, I think, recover without the support of the United States. So they absolutely are going to spend a lot of effort in November, not only on the presidential race, but all the others as well, because they realize this, for them, could be lights out.
How likely is it that this was not an accident, but purposeful? I have had more than a few people, Gordon, ask me, is this biological warfare versus an accident from a marketplace or something? What do you say about that?
Yeah, I don't think it was an intentional release. And then actually some Chinese talk about this as well as people in Beijing trying to get rid of Xi Jinping. But I do believe that it is possible that this was an accidental release from that P4 biosafety lab in Wuhan. We just don't know. What we do know is that China has done its best to prevent foreign virologists and epidemiologists from studying the origins of the outbreak. That should make us suspicious. I think that China has seen the power of biological warfare. So I'm sure that the light has gone on in Beijing if it wasn't on before. Right now, Iran is crippled. And Russia probably is.
Coming up.
It was a genuine emergency, and we rose to the occasion. I was really proud of my colleague.
Mitch McConnell's Finest Hour in the next segment of our program.
Hi, I'm Jim Daly with Focus on the Family. The coronavirus pandemic has made life chaotic and unpredictable for everyone. It's in times like these we search for something we can truly count on. We need a true north. In the current crisis, I believe true north is loving your neighbor as yourself. And we can do that by using our time and talent and resources to help assist someone who is vulnerable or in need. And let's remember, together we'll get through this.
Our program is coming in today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who are impacting public policy and serving in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. It is no surprise that President Trump has been subjected to mocking from elite media about what they've called his late response to the coronavirus. Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton was early on this, offering advice on this virus to the president in mid-January and to his colleagues in Congress when Congress was consumed, however, with a partisan impeachment. Senator Cotton, a favorite guest on my show, recently recalled with me what actually happened. Politico recognized yesterday you were the first elected leader to the bell. Are both of those claims, in your opinion, true?
Well, Hugh, the first time I recall talking about the China virus in the media was on your show, probably late January, after I'd started studying the problem in mid-January. And I have to tell you that in mid-January, in late January, unfortunately, Washington, especially the Congress, was consumed with another matter. You may recall the partisan impeachment of the president. I was focused on the time of what I thought was going to be a growing crisis coming out of Wuhan. And unfortunately, it's been proven correct.
Now, I believe you also were accurately reported to have warned the president repeatedly and that the president took your warning seriously and closed inbound flights from China, a point that is always overlooked by Beltway media. How important was that action?
More than 20,000 passengers landed from mainland China in the United States every single day. So by cutting off traffic in late January, the president bought us valuable weeks so we could continue to try to use the time we have to develop the resources we need, hospital beds, ICU beds, ventilators, personal protective equipment, and so forth. You got to remember, too, that that was a widely ridiculed decision at the time. Joe Biden said it was hysterical and xenophobic, to give you a sense of what Joe Biden would do if he were president as it relates to China.
A lot of the Beltway media did not take it seriously until death began to occur. And now they are attempting to blame the president. I just have never seen the media this partisan, Tom Cotton.
Yeah, I have to say to you that the press conferences that the president and Vice President Pence and their task force hold every day are very informative. I've had lots of Arkansans contact me and say that they are must-watch television for them because it's the best source of information they can get about what's happening and what's next. Yet when they turn it over to the Q&A from the press there, it really is just a kind of media preening that you too often see at the White House, but that you especially wouldn't like to see in the middle of a global pandemic.
I'm ashamed of people in the media who are ridiculing people in the private sector who are doing everything when the media is doing very little other than inspire fear in people.
Yeah, I got to say, I found that pretty amazing yesterday. So Mike Lindell is going to start making 50,000 masks a day at his pillow and sheet factories. And left wingers at places like The Atlantic or MSNBC or CNN just want to take shots at him for being a supporter of the president or being on Fox News a lot. I'm not sure how many masks they've made over The Atlantic, but I bet it's a lot fewer than 50,000 a day.
So in terms of the private sector generally, do you believe we have a hell of a kick? Do you think we're catching up in every critical category?
Unlike any other nation in the world, any other nation in history, Hugh, remember, the battles of World War II were not just fought on the beaches of Normandy or the islands of the South Pacific. They were fought in the auto factories in the American Midwest, factories all around the world, what we call the arsenal for democracy. And although we may be slow to awake from our slumber, the giant of American industry is powerful, unlike any other nation's industry in the world.
The U.S. Senate has been busier than ever over these last few weeks, possibly more so than any comparable period in recent history. As we fight this virus and watch the economic challenges mount, the aid package passed last week sent a very clear message to the American people. Help is on the way. And a ton of the credit goes to Mitch McConnell. The Senate Majority Leader was a guest on my program. The health of your 99 colleagues and of your staffs, I know, is first and foremost on your mind. To your knowledge, is everyone doing okay?
As far as I know, as you know, I had four members either in quarantine or one tested positive, which is why four of my members missed the unanimous vote last week. As far as I know, they're all doing well.
It's good. Now, that unanimous vote, until 2 weeks ago, I had thought the finest hour of your tenure as leader of the Senate would have been the decision to hold open the seat vacated by the untimely death of Justice Scalia. Now I think it's that rescue package. I'm wondering in your own mind where you rank the relative importance of those two events.
Well, they were both quite important, no question about it. Very different situation. This was a genuine national emergency, and trying to put together a $2 trillion bill in a week was really a Herculean task, as you can imagine. The way I thought it would work best would be for those of us in the Senate to try to get started on a bipartisan basis, and we were doing really quite well, as you may recall, until the Speaker of the House decided to insert herself into the process, which created a couple of days of unnecessary partisan sniping. But we got past that, and in the end, I think the best evidence is that there was not a single vote against it. It was a genuine emergency, and we rose to the occasion. I was really proud of my colleagues.
I have never seen 2 days in the Senate like those 2 days. I actually was watching on C-SPAN because it was unprecedented, with perhaps the exception of the Kavanaugh and Thomas hearings, but this was on the floor. Have you ever seen anything like it, Leader?
Well, occasionally people lose their tempers. I think, you know, what really is noteworthy about this is we pivoted from the most partisan thing you could possibly be involved in, the impeachment of a president, to a unanimous vote on a $2 trillion package, all within a couple of months. So we did have an outbreak of you know, kind of the old-fashioned impeachment partisanship, which I think was generated by the speaker trying to, you know, get into the Senate process.
There is obviously going to be a need for another bill. I look at the restaurant industry, where 3% of restaurants have closed completely forever, maybe double digits. I look at the broadcast industry, some segments of it without revenue. Will there be a phase four, and how will that develop, Leader McConnell?
Well, I think we'll have to wait and see. Remember, this bill was only signed into law last Friday, so it's only been law for about 4 days, and the speaker's already talking about another bill that, you know, I think you have to genuinely be aware of the speaker in a situation like this. I'm reminded of what Rahm Emanuel said during the financial crisis, never let a crisis go to waste. What that meant was seize on the crisis to try to achieve unrelated policy items that you have not been able to get under other circumstances. So I would think any kind of bill coming out of the House, I would look at like Reagan suggested we look at the Russians, trust but verify.
I hear you. Leader, I want to touch about pandemic bonds. I know the president's intrigued by them. The Treasury doesn't have to have authority to issue them. Do you think we ought to try and involve citizens in this effort to pay for all the public health infrastructure that's got to stand up?
I think it's an interesting idea. And we're looking at every idea that people can participate. And I think what the way the American people have responded to this is really inspirational. I mean, people reaching out and helping others, not to mention the heroic healthcare workers who are exposing themselves to this public health crisis by taking care of these sick patients. I think the country is responding in a way that is reminiscent of the attitude and after 9/11. And it's really, as I said, inspiring to all of us who've been elected.
For the complete conversation with Leader McConnell, go to townhallreview.com. Coming up.
Last night I got an email from the White House. They had reissued the letter. Now, in typical bureaucratic fashion, the only thing they changed to was they said, okay, well, we said 10,000 a day. Well, what we meant was 10,000 per batch.
Ohio leadership takes big steps in defeating the coronavirus. When the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt continues in a moment. Hey, thanks for listening to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Our podcast is sponsored by Alliance Defending Freedom. ADF provides help at no cost to those whose liberty is being violated, but they can't do it without your help. Call 800-691-8969. That's 800-691-8969. Or visit townhallreview.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. In a number of ways, our nation was flat-footed when this crisis first hit. But now we're seeing our country do what it did in World War II. We're going to put on our game face and we're going to fight this thing. We are rising to the occasion. It feels a lot like war mobilization must have felt to those in 1941 and 42. Ohio is very much a part of this. From the leadership of Governor Mike DeWine and my next guest, the Attorney General in the Buckeye State, David Yost. Would you walk the audience through the Battelle story, and then we'll tease out the lessons for the country going forward? It's great news how it ended up, but man, it was bumpy.
Everybody knows we've got a huge shortage of PPE, personal protective equipment, which includes these N95 masks. Now, a single hospital will go through thousands, tens of thousands of these in a day. They're meant to be disposable. And because of panic buying and because of huge demand, you can't find them anymore. They just aren't out there. With the COVID infections ramping up and we're told spiking sometime within the next month, this is going to be a crisis. Well, Battelle, a scientific research organization, world class here in Columbus, Ohio, had developed a system. The bottom line is they were able to show that they can reuse these masks. and have these machines that they've built that allows that to happen. There's only one trouble. You got to play Mother May I in this field, emergency or not, and Mother is named FDA. And so after a week of begging on bended knee to have permission in the middle of a public health emergency to use a proven technology, by the way, that was tested and the FDA has the report on their own website since 2016. We still couldn't get approval. Finally, we got news that they had approved it for 10,000 masks per day. I mean, you might as well not do it. Well, the governor...
What's the capacity of Battelle, by the way, Attorney General Yost? How many masks a day with their existing machines? And they will build more. But right now, what was their existing capacity a day?
160,000. You're talking more than an order of magnitude difference here.
So they were approved for 10,000 a day based upon long-held data testing equipment. And it's an NDA, a new drug application, new technology application. I understand it. But the FDA is the hibernating bear of the government. They don't do anything new ever in a hurry for good reasons when it comes to new drugs. But a proven technology in emergency and then to approve 10,000. I looked at that and said either they're killing 10,000 people a day or they're denying 150,000 people a day a life-saving mask.
Well, Governor Wine swung into action, pointed out how insane it is, and I threatened to take him to court if they didn't get this fixed. The president himself got involved, and at about 10 o'clock last night, I got an email from the White House telling me that they had reissued the letter. Now, in typical bureaucratic fashion, the only thing they changed to was they said, okay, well, we said 10,000 a day. What we meant was 10,000 per batch. And they removed the geographic limitation.
Oh, my God. Who signed that letter? Who signed the letter, David Yost?
I don't have it in front of me. I'm assuming it was the commissioner.
You know, someone in that agency screwed up. And you know what? I'm not interested in heads on pikes. I'm interested in that person and everybody at the FDA learning this is not a time for agency capture. Because you know who would not like this? The manufacturer of masks will not like this. Because what they used to sell one time is now, how many times can they reuse it? Do you know, David Yost?
About 20.
So all of a sudden their demand curve went down by 95%. I believe my math is correct. And you know what? Doesn't matter in this time, but boy, they're going to hate that. That's what I always feared, that this was regulatory capture. Someone who makes masks telling the FDA you can't approve this because you're going to kill my business. Do you have any idea? Did they give you any explanation why it took them so long?
We'll have to leave that for another day. I don't have any facts to suggest regulatory capture here, but your argument is certainly the least hypothesis. I should point out that the approval is only for Battelle. It's not for the process for other people. It only lasts for the duration of the emergency. So there are some guardrails in place that will prevent this from creating disruption in the marketplace going into the future. Whether that's a good thing or not is probably going to depend on your view of the economy.
Coming up.
It begins with an acknowledgement to yourself, really, that you have biases, and you better not let them interfere with your coverage. You know, lawyers do this every day. Judges do this every day in the work that they do.
Britt Hume on media bias. When the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Our program is coming today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. Britt Hume has been a towering figure on the national news for over 30 years. He first captured national attention as ABC's White House chief correspondent in the 90s. But when he took the reins at the fledgling Fox News Channel as its managing editor, he turned a lot of heads. my colleague Steve Cortez spoke with Britt on the topic of media bias. From Chicago's AM 560, The Answer.
It's clear from anyone who watches you now that you tend to be a conservative. However, it seems to me that you, as a reporter for all those years, and look, every reporter, of course, is going to have views. We're human beings, and nobody's a robot. But it seems to me that you were very much able, and most reporters were able, to put those in check and still try to be as objective as possible about reporting when your job wasn't being a commentator as it is now. Is that correct?
Well, that's what we all tried to do, and it wasn't so much that we were objective. It was that we tried to be neutral in our coverage. It's not terribly hard to do, and it begins with an acknowledgement to yourself, really, that you have biases, and you better not let them interfere with your coverage. You know, lawyers do this every day. Judges do this every day in the work that they do. And once you acknowledge to yourself that you do have a bias, it's not very hard to do it.
Right.
I fear in recent years, however, over the decades, the discipline to do that has been lost.
Right.
And journalists now are, and partly I think, Steve, it sprung from Watergate when journalists showed that, you know, a couple of young journalists by some hard work and, you know, careful editing showed that they could unhorse a president,
right,
at least do the reporting that led to that. And that was the most heady, the most exciting, the most glorious experience in maybe certainly in the modern history of the trade.
Right.
And reporters have been trying to relive it ever since.
Right. No, that's a good point. And you and I have talked about that, you know, off air, that they all want to be all the president's men. And by the way, proper skepticism, in my view, is the role of actual journalists. And again, I'm separating here journalists from commentators. You are now a commentator. You know, I am clearly a commentator. I never pretend to be a journalist. But what I also think, Britt, and I say this as somebody, I'm one of the few people who's been a broadcaster for all three major cable networks in the last 10 years. There are a lot of supposed journalists at those networks who are every bit as much an activist as I am. On the other side, they are, but they won't be transparent about that. They want the veil, the guise of their masquerading, in my view, as journalists, when in fact they are advocates and activists. And I just think transparency would be so useful both for them and for the American people. Your thoughts?
Well, I think that transparency might be useful, but I think that the American people are not foolish.
Sure.
They can see this, and they can see right through it. So transparency becomes something the public is able to establish just from looking at the work and hearing the way people behave. You know, this coronavirus story has been a wonderful example, because you look at these daily briefings that the White House is giving. Now,
right.
Trump gets up and he says all kinds of stuff, and he brags and he rambles and he, you know, gets into exchanges with reporters who ask, you know, gotcha questions and so on. He doesn't need to do that. I wish he wouldn't.
Right.
But when he steps aside, that briefing platform becomes an absolute fount of information.
Right.
You know, Mike Pence goes through all the things that government entities and agencies are doing. A lot of information there. And then Drs. Birx and Fauci step up and they analyze the data, which is getting richer all the time as we test. And they have tremendous insights into what's going on, and they're there to answer your questions. A couple of days ago, after a lot of grumbling about whether Trump's briefings shouldn't be broadcast at all because there's too much propaganda, CNN and MSNBC broadcast the Trump part of the briefing and cut away from the rest of it.
Right.
So it raises this question, Steve. What story are these outfits trying to cover?
Right.
It doesn't seem to be the coronavirus outbreak.
Right.
And the questions that I hear from the briefings are all about, you know, whether the president, to establish whether the president's in some kind of a dispute with this governor or that governor.
Right.
Which, you know, that's a legitimate story, but it's on page 6. The page 1 story, it seems to me, is the stuff that we're getting from the federal government's leading authorities on the spread of the disease, the extent of it, the lethality of it, how worried we should be, where it is spreading, what the latest data show about, you know, whether the situation in New York is worsening the way it looks like it has, or whether the hospital beds will be enough and all that. And that's the stuff they're great on. That's the big story. But you look at the lead story. Trump at loggerheads with Fauci over over whether to reopen the government. Of course, right. The president has not said when he's going to reopen the government or reopen the country, really. Right. And he doesn't have authority to do sure. all of that anyway. But that's what they want to cover. You know, they want to cover whether there's and Fauci and company have said over and over again, they're really not at loggerheads about this. The right. president would like to see it happen. He made it clear once again today in the briefing that he's not going to do it before it's safe to do so.
Right. When you hopped over to Fox News from ABC, though, in the 1990s, it was a fledgling network. You were there at almost the very beginning of Fox News. You were already quite prominent and well-known and respected at ABC, so it was a big deal for you to move to this then fledgling network. It must be strange for you at times to now know that Fox News, which you're still with, is now the gorilla of cable news and now very much dominates that medium. It must be fascinating for you.
Well, it's gratifying that Fox News has been successful. I found the decision to go over there from ABC News, which was the top rated ABC News at the time, was top rated evening newscast. Nightline was a huge success, and so ABC News was arguably the number one network in news. And people, I think, felt that I was leaving the Yankees or the or the Houston Astros or another championship team to go to an expansion team.
Right.
I was, obviously, but I was not going to just any expansion team. I knew Rupert Murdoch, and unlike a lot of my colleagues, I didn't think he was the Antichrist. I thought he was a good guy, and a guy I wouldn't mind working for, and I haven't. And I thought the concept of trying to balance the news and allow more conservative views to be heard was the right concept. I've said more than once that the problem with Trump is he thinks everything's about him, and the problem with his critics is that they do too.
Right.
And, everything kind of goes back to Trump. And the people who hate him, everything he touches, they hate. I noticed today on Twitter, for example, that the character assassination of Elizabeth Birx has now begun.
Coming up.
I'm an optimist. They said this would take a year to get. We did it in 2 weeks. He's engaging private sector, and this is what he's doing. Why not have these people there, these companies, to help this country so we can get back to work?
Mike Lindell of MyPillow.com on the final segment of our program. Stay with us. If you enjoy the Town Hall Review and you are a person of faith, let me introduce you to another podcast I think you'll like. It's the Christian Outlook. And in it, you'll hear the leading voices in the Christian world engaging the issue of the day. This week, doctors see promise in a drug to help those suffering from coronavirus.
I don't know of any physician that basically wouldn't give this to his family member or to himself if he would become COVID-19 positive.
Police arrest a pastor who held services that risked lives.
Would it ever be valid for a pastor to be arrested merely for holding services at his church? The answer is yes, sometimes, but it would have to be extremely rare.
Are some lives really worth more than others?
It's a really toxic discussion. It's a really toxic way of looking at the world.
All this and more. To subscribe, go to ChristianOutlook.com. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt.
I think these briefings could be, better designed. The president could come out, say a few words in terms of what his administration is doing, not have these, PR stunts like Mr. Pillow coming out and giving a plug for his company and that sort of thing.
So said CNN's lead Trump critic Jim Acosta on Mike Lindell's appearance with the president in the Rose Garden last week. Seb Gorka spoke with Lindell on his efforts to serve our nation. From America First with Sebastian Gorka.
Let's be clear here why you were there. The president, with the help of Abbott Industries, unveiled the new point-of-care testing machine that tells you within 5 minutes if you have the coronavirus. And you were there, Mike, to say what? 75% of your MyPillow production capacities has now been dedicated to what?
To making face masks. We're up to 10,000 a day, and I hope to get to 50,000 a day. But I'll tell you, also, We got, you know, calls from across the country. I'm doing checking on sanitizers and the other kind of mask, and we just went into full help for the people, and it's amazing.
You are living the American life. You are helping the first line of response against this threat, and then we have this kind of reaction. This is Abilio Jim Acosta reacting to Mike Lindell's incredible speech at the White House.
I think these briefings could be, I think, better designed. The president could come out, say a few words in terms of what his administration is doing, not have these, you know, PR stunts like Mr. Pillow coming out and giving a plug for his company and that sort of thing.
I'm an optimist, and I left that White House and listened to how the president is getting, you know, hey, Mike, you know, look at this. They said this would take a year to get. We did it in 2 weeks. He's engaging private sector, and this is what he's doing. Why not have these people there that are, you know, these companies that have all in to help this country so we can get back to work?
Tell us why you took that decision. Why you decided to dedicate the majority of your capacity when other businesses are surviving just to stay alive. You're making masks for our first responders.
Yeah, well, first I want to correct that. We're not making N95.
Sorry, no, you're making the cloth ones. You're making the cloth ones, correct.
The cotton, and what we are in a great position where we're hearing all over where we think we're going to get N95s. Whatever we're getting out to the hospitals as fast as we can and the first responders. About a week and a half ago, a couple weeks ago, I said, I've got to help out. The president was reaching out, you know, for a private sector to get involved, anybody that could be, and I had heard that. And I called up the vice president's office. I did my due diligence, but my passion is to help people and help us get back where, you know, we've got to get through this and save lives. Right now, it's saving lives.
Thank you for joining us for the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. All God's best to you and yours during these uncertain times. Stay with us here and with me on my program, and we continue to bring you the latest news and the information you need, the analysis you want. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Schubin and producers Charlie Richard, David Posian, Michael Cook, Adam Ramsey, Ben Brigman, and of course, Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsors, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. I am Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining us.